Nukes and AI. Artificial intelligence is here to stay, and it's involved in much more than warped Facebook memes showing three-legged models and hands with two extra thumbs. So to what extent is AI involved in nuclear matters? If the military uses AI, what are the chances that some emotionless, empathy-less digital bot can decide to launch Armageddon without human intervention? It takes a genuine expert, one who has been at the pinnacle of the military's Strategic Air Command, to tell us,
what's the role for artificial intelligence? What's the role for autonomy? And I think that as we think these things through, and particularly inside the department, as they think these things through, I think it's important to begin by saying, this is what we believe this should do for us. This is how it assists the human beings. This is not how it takes the place of the human beings. This is what it's good for. This is what we need. And that's, I've heard General Cotton talk about that as well, by saying, what is artificial intelligence good for? We are swimming, we are drowning in data. Can it help us sort that out? And if so, how do we want to do it with the safeguards in place that we know that we're not going to be misled?
Well, when the former head of the Strategic Air Command, General C. Robert Keller, retired, brings some clarity and knowledge to the dilemma of AI and the military, you understand that some seats are hotter than others when it comes to that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine, keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, part two of an interview with General C. Robert Keller, retired, former head of the Strategic Air Command, as he gives us an inside view of nuclear policy and methodology from the very top of the command chain. This is the second half of an interview conducted at last December's Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit. Part 1 aired 2 weeks ago on Nuclear Hot Seat number 723. This week, we hear General Keller's personal thoughts, he is retired, his personal thoughts on AI in the military, and much more. And we revisit a talk with Mary Beth Gallagher, Director of Engagements for New York-based Domini Impact Investments, a woman-led mutual fund with the stated goal of investing for universal human dignity and ecological sustainability. Mary Beth lifts the veil on what it takes to make certain your funds, however limited they might be, do not go towards any company that manufactures nukes. Today is Tuesday, May 20th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. This week, we hear part two of an interview with General C. Robert Keller, USAF retired. He is former commander of the Strategic Air Command, and here he gives us an inside view of nuclear policy and methodology from the very top of the command chain. It's a rare opportunity to hear about nuclear situations from a military perspective, not from one who opposes nuclear, but from someone who was an integral part of the system to manage nuclear weapons and, if the circumstances arose, assist with their launch. Here he addresses AI, artificial intelligence, and other topics. This is excerpted from last December's Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in D.C., Part 1 aired on Nuclear Hot Seat 723 2 weeks ago. And this interview was conducted by W.J. Bill Hennigan of the New York Times, recorded on December 6, 2024.
I do think that there are possibly millions of Americans, almost assuredly millions of Americans, who are concerned that it would be an intentional launch order rather than a misunderstanding. But I want to touch on something that you pointed out. Yes, there are humans at every point in the chain. But, you know, the emergence of artificial intelligence has kind of sparked this conversation about introducing AI into the system because, you know, you have less reaction time and AI can sort through things that humans are just simply incapable of doing. I've heard General Cotton talk about that they're thinking about AI, but that it would stay any power over launch and any of that would stay with active service members. But looking ahead here and seeing there are benefits of AI, do you have any concerns about that finding its way into command and control?
I hate to use the word concern, so let me just say caution. I think that we need to be cautious about how we do it. And I think we need to go back. What's the fundamental principle here? For nuclear command and control in particular, it's humans in the loop. Nothing happens automatically. Specially certified systems that we can rely on because we have dual phenomenology, we have redundancies, we have other ways that we're not relying on one single source with one single voice doing the talking. It is a deliberative process. And remember what I said, since the end of the Cold War, the sense of urgency has receded. So the likelihood that people would see something happening and automatically presume that this was Armageddon beginning is not the same perspective that you find throughout the uniforms today as you found perhaps in the Cold War, when that was sort of the driving issue on everything that we did. It wasn't to, you know, make it so. It was to understand that we had an adversary who threatened that actively and then had the wherewithal to do it. So being sure that we could survive, that we were resilient, that we could respond, and that gets all the way up to launching under attack, which is another thing that concerns lots of people, that capability existed to enhance deterrence. So I think since deterrence remains foundational, I think it's still important to remember that the sense of urgency is not the same today that it was then. And so that's one piece of this. But the other pieces of this, I think, are equally compelling. Multiple sources, a recognition that people might be trying to feed us false information. It's happening every day, sort of in the unclassified ways that we all see these things. And so what's the role for artificial intelligence? What's the role for autonomy? And I think that as we think these things through, and particularly inside the department, as they think these things through, I think it's important to begin by saying, this is what we believe this should do for us. This is how it assists the human beings. This is not how it takes the place of the human beings. This is what it's good for. This is what we need. And that's, I've heard General Cotton talk about that as well, by saying, what is artificial intelligence good for? We are swimming, we're drowning in data. Can it help us sort that out? And if so, how do we want to do it with the safeguards in place that we know that we're not going to be misled? And then ultimately, in the decision process, there's a conference that occurs among advisors and the commander-in-chief. I think a caution about artificial intelligence is appropriate. A caution about autonomy is appropriate. I think we could think about artificial intelligence and autonomy the same way we think about human beings. When we send an airman out to do a mission or we send a pilot out to fly a mission, they are doing that within a set of rules of engagement. We need to provide an autonomous system with rules of engagement, just as we would a human. What do those rules look like? How do we think our way through that? And I know there are people actively thinking their way through it. You know, we've flown drones now for quite some time, and a lot of lessons have been learned from all of that. And we see things unfolding in Ukraine, for example. There are huge changes coming here in not the nature of war, but the character of war. And so how do we manage these things? I think it's critically important.
You pointed out that the U.S. government hasn't took a holiday when it came to investing in nuclear weapons. It wasn't just the delivery systems, which is the most visible part of it, you know, the bombers, the subs, the ICBMs, the missiles. But it's also our ability to build these weapons, the warheads themselves, and the various labs are now trying to reconstitute that capability. It's very costly. It's challenging as well because we have a kind of a gap in between, you know, those that are experienced in doing this sort of work and the younger people who came of age trying to learn about it. So they're trying to bridge that gap. It's very challenging. It's all going to cost, you know, almost $2 trillion over 30 years. Do you think that the United States should rethink the way that it's going about its modernization effort? Do you think that, you know, this sort of one-for-one replacement of swapping out these older systems and putting in new ones in their stead should be rethought in a way because there has been technology advances, there are new capabilities, that perhaps we don't need to just step in the same footprint that we established during the Cold War?
Yeah, I think it's always good to look at all of that. I think we the military need to make sure that we are always looking at those factors for all the obvious reasons. And I think the American public should insist that we look at all those things for those obvious reasons as well. But I think you need to step back and say, so what makes the most strategic sense for us to maintain the deterrent? And my personal view is there isn't anything that makes more strategic sense for us than to sustain the triad. And that's because the three big attributes in the triad continue to make sense. And those attributes are survivability. And of course, we get that today out of our ballistic missile submarine. Each of the legs has a little bit of each of these. But primarily, we rely on the submarines to provide the most survivable part of the force. And that's why, under New START rules, we would ultimately deploy, if all the submarines were deployed, most of our weapons would be deployed in a survivable fashion at sea. We also maintain an ICBM force because they are responsive.
Hair trigger alert?
There is no such thing as a hair trigger alert. They are a rapid response force. They're not aimed at any target today other than broad ocean areas. They would have to be retargeted if given a presidential order to launch. They can be retargeted pretty quickly, but they do not sit there on any targets on any landmass on a day-to-day basis. We pick broad ocean areas, and there are a series of steps throughout all of the forces that you have to go to, which is why hair triggers suggest to me that, you know, it's the old cowboy thing, right? That's a pistol we're talking about there, that they filed off all the stuff and put, you know, did all that stuff, and they've cocked the hammer, and the cowboy is standing there with his finger on the trigger. That is not the way those forces are on a day-to-day basis. They have to cock the hammer, then you pull the trigger. The hammer cocking part needs to come to them in a message. So those are unlock codes. The weapons are locked on a day-to-day basis. So that's not new. That's not new news either. That's something that we've said for a very long time. So that's different than the cowboy perception of hair trigger. Let me get back to the modernization piece. So modernization of the ICBM force makes sense to me as well. People talk about the vulnerability of the ICBMs. The ICBMs are vulnerable, have been vulnerable for a long time, to a massive attack from the Russians. That's what it takes. So Russian planners have to contend under New START limits. In particular, they've got to contend with how do you deal with the ICBM force. And then finally, we have the bomber force, which is the most flexible. You can put them on nuclear alert or not. You can use them in a conventional sense. And of course, one of the policy directives that the military has had for quite some time here is look for ways that we can substitute conventional weapons for nuclear weapons, which is a planning challenge. It's not that you can't do it in some cases. It's a challenge to the planners to make sure that they are thinking that way. And so you can do that as well. And so you can launch bombers. You can put them on what are called positive control turnaround points. They go to a certain point, and they wait. And so I did have authority as the commander of STRATCOM, if we had bombers on alert, to launch them for survivability, and they would go as far as a specific point, and they would wait. And if they didn't get an order to go, they would come home. And that order to go would have to come from the president, the sole authority. So the modernization effort that's underway in the B-21, which is underway, which is a stealth platform to ultimately replace the B-2 in larger numbers, and then a modernization program for the B-52 makes sense to me. The B-52 is an unbelievable platform. Tankers, supporting tankers are important as well. I also think that given the two nuclear pier problem and the issue in the Pacific, I am in favor of redeploying a nuclear armed cruise missile on selected platforms. That was one of the things that the Posture Commission talked about. And I'm in favor of that. I think that, remember now, we have nuclear weapons for three purposes. One is deterrence. One is assurance. We're extending our nuclear umbrella to our allies. And that's the assurance piece of this. And by the way, in deterrence, the adversary gets a vote. In assurance, the ally gets a vote. And if you've been keeping up to date with the conversations we've been having with the South Koreans, for example, now that the North Koreans are nuclear armed, new arrangements, new policy level arrangements being made there to make sure that there's closer consultation, same thing with the Japanese, etc. They are under the nuclear threat there now in a way that they haven't been before.
Would you advocate other land-based systems, for instance, now that we're no longer under INF?
Again, my personal opinion, I am comfortable at this point with the theater systems that we've deployed. Remember now, the F-35 has now been nuclear certified, and there's a new gravity warhead for them to be able to use, all of our aircraft to be able to use, that the labs are producing. And you asked a question about the labs before, too, and I'm equally concerned about the ability of the labs to keep up. You know, remember now that our nuclear infrastructure is an industrial infrastructure. It has the same problems that lots of other industries do with talent and experience. And remember now that we have asked the Department of Energy to tell us every year that the stockpile is safe, secure, and reliable. And they are doing that now since 1992 in an era of no nuclear testing, no nuclear detonations. Now, they can test the electronics and other things that they do, but with no nuclear yield. And so how do you do it? Well, they've come up with a way to basically replace the actual detonations with simulations.
While you're talking, I'm just thinking about, there was a real period of time there where we're talking about getting all this, the machine going again, which they've started, right? And traveled across the country to see all these different places where they're building the bomber. They're building the missiles, they're building the new warheads, they're building the new subs. And it's a challenge, but I have this question to myself, like, was there a period of time, could we have done something different during that period of time where we were continually reducing, we were rolling it back? I know that our adversaries also have a vote, and they made aggressive decisions that we are responding to. But we did have a period of time where things had settled down. And do you believe that, was there something that could have been done in that grace period that could have staved off where we find ourselves today?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer. People have speculated, was there a lost opportunity there somewhere along the way? I don't know. Hindsight is perfect, I think. I don't know. I will add, though, something to your earlier question. All of these modernization efforts and the policy way forward, of course, there will be a new administration. And I don't know what the new administration will do with any or all of this. They will certainly have their own view about how to shape it all. And so we'll have to wait and see. I have no insight. I don't know what
I can make a guess.
I'm gonna say. I don't speculate on those things. You can guess away.
Yeah. So, space. What about those aliens at Area 50? No. Yeah.
Well, look, I can tell you. It's incredible how often I got that question, by the way.
I'm sure. So we just published a story that basically talked a little bit about the analysis that went into this Russian spacecraft that U.S. intelligence says is testing components for a orbital nuclear weapon. The essay makes the argument that we're now at a place, we're investing in space at a clip that I think would be pretty hard to imagine even 10 years ago in terms of the number of satellites on orbit. The U.S. military, as you well know, almost all of the capabilities are derived from space in some capacity. What would you like to see within the next, 4 years in the Trump administration? What are things that you'd like to see happen to reduce risk, to turn this bad trajectory that we seem to be on around?
There are two things, and it wouldn't matter whose administration. That it doesn't matter to me. The conversation we've been having is agnostic about all that from my perspective. And so I think there are a couple of things. One is, although this may sound contrarian to some of you, the modernization effort is a bipartisan effort, and we should, let me replace that word, we must continue with the modernization effort for the nuclear deterrent. I think it's foundational. As far as I can see in the future, it's going to remain foundational. I understand that there are some people who believe that global zero is the right goal. I don't disagree. The question is, how quickly do you think you could get there? And in my humble view, anyway, the world situation doesn't lend itself to that pathway at this time. So I think we're going to need a nuclear deterrent as far into the strategic future as I can see. And I think that promotes stability. The second thing is we need to talk to one another. We were trying, even while I was in the seat at Stratcom, to renew mill-to-mill conversations. That's not the only place where we need to talk. We need to talk at the policy level, too. But there is something about mill-to-mill conversation among military professionals that creates understanding. And I think that's sorely lacking today, particularly with the Chinese, because I don't think we have that kind of relationship. Over time in the Cold War, we developed that kind of relationship with our Soviet counterparts, and I think that was beneficial. Even when we got mad at one another, that's when it was really beneficial, right? It's really beneficial if you're mad at one another. So I think that restoring those conversations as soon as we can, as best as we can, and I'm never one who says talk just to talk, but I do think that restoring those contacts that become more of a routine set of contacts is very, very important. Finally, I would always urge consistency in U.S. policy related to nuclear matters. Again, are changes warranted? Well, every administration comes in with their views about what needs to be changed. So be it. That's fine. But again, I think we've been remarkably consistent over decades with our nuclear posture and our nuclear thinking. So I think that every administration adds something along the way. I think that we have seen policy improvements along the way. And so I would just advise any administration of any party persuasion with anyone coming in the door to look carefully at our nuclear posture again and then make those sensible changes that are probably wise.
That was General C. Robert Keller, USAF retired, former commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, interviewed by W.J. Bill Hennigan, correspondent, New York Times Opinion, as part of last December's Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit in Washington, D.C. Our thanks to the Outrider Foundation for holding the Nuclear Reporting Summit in the first place and for their permission to use this interview. We'll continue with this week's second featured interview in just a moment. But first, with so many worrying things going on in the world, why do you need to think about nuclear as well? Because the radiation released from the entire nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, refinement and manufacture, nuclear reactors, weapons and waste, will last in human lifespan terms forever. And the decisions we make now, the actions taken, will have consequences beyond our imagining. If we want to avoid our descendants, we should be so lucky as to have them, screaming back at us through time, "What were you thinking?" Attention must be paid now, while there's still time to do something, and that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We keep you up to date on not only what's going on with the nuclear industry and governments, but what you can do about it. Every week we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart, or time, or money to put on the air or in print. Our stories have been sourced, checked, and footnoted. We interview genuine experts with great credentials, and we also tell you about the triumphs and challenges of activists on the front line around the world. But we can't keep doing this work without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations. We need your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation or a monthly recurring gift, with any amount you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donation is tax deductible. So quick, right now, go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or you can send directly to us via Zelle at info@nuclearhotseat.com. That's nuclearhotseat.com to donate now, and whatever you can do to help, know that I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's second featured interview. Want to know how to stop a nuke? Follow the money. And then take it away from the nuclear industry. Would you like to know how? Keep listening. We're talking with Mary Beth Gallagher, who is Director of Engagements for Domini Impact Investments, a mutual fund firm that's woman-led and, among other ethical choices, does not invest in any company that manufactures any part of nuclear weapons. I initially heard her speak at the United Nations Second Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons. Listening to the quality and clarity of her information, and knowing that she works closely with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, I knew that the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat deserved to hear what she had to say. I spoke with Mary Beth Gallagher on January 26, 2024. Mary Beth Gallagher, it's great to have you here with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, Libby. So nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start out with your background. First of all, how did you get to be a financial advisor?
My role is Director of Engagement at Domini Impact Investments, which is a mutual fund company investment firm. And I think my path to this role is like kind of even surprising to me. I studied environmental science and was a Peace Corps volunteer and really committed to doing climate change activism. And I'm a lawyer. I studied international human rights law and did a lot of advocacy work, really looking at the issues of our time around climate change and human rights, women's equality, and did advocacy work with like the United Nations, with human rights defenders, trying to change policies and practices. I'm really passionate about a lot of these issues and kind of found my way into the financial community, first working with a community of faith-based investors, seeing that the role of finance of corporations in our society was really critical and that investors have an opportunity to try to influence how companies operate, how responsible they are, how they treat their workers, and that working in the financial community was an opportunity to really think about what it means to support sustainable, healthy, resilient financial systems that don't leave people and the planet behind.
How long have you been with this financial institution doing this work?
Sure. So I joined Domini about 3 years ago in 2021. And prior to that, I was with a group called Investor Advocates for Social Justice for about 8 years. So in total, I've been in this field about 10 years.
What is the general stance within the financial community towards investing in nuclear weapons creating companies?
The general stance, I think, is probably pretty varied. I think there are some firms that don't think about the role of weapons, and others like our firm that really think about like how you align what you choose to invest in with what you care about.
Give us an example by letting us know what your company's, Domini's, stance is towards nuclear weapons.
Sure. So Domini is a women-led mutual fund company with a commitment to impact investing. We were founded about 30 years ago. And as we look at like our role in the financial system and what we invest in, we have a set of impact investment standards. So that guides how we evaluate what companies to invest in. And there are some sectors that we just automatically avoid, like fossil fuels, tobacco, immigrant detention centers, as well as nuclear weapons. So we have a screen against investing in nuclear weapons. We don't invest in any companies that manufacture them. We don't invest in companies that produce nuclear power. And then we also look at different institutions that may have connections to the nuclear weapons issue, like universities or also governments that have large nuclear arsenals.
In the general financial community, have there been any changes in their stance towards nuclear weapons creating companies in recent years?
I think since the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force in 2021, you have seen more investment institutions looking at screens and prohibitions against nuclear weapons. There's a really useful resource that's been developed by PACS called Don't Bank on the Bomb. And their recent report from 2023 showed that the number of investors that are either have a screen completely excluding nuclear weapons like Domini does, or the firms that are looking closely at it and selectively excluding nuclear companies has increased over time. So I think that number is around 110 investment firms that are completely excluding investments in nuclear weapons or reducing that exposure. And I think that's grown progressively over time as that report has been done, periodically looking at those firms that have a public position. And you're seeing more investors, I think, look at this because of the role of the treaty and because that brings in potential enabling actors in production of nuclear weapons, which may touch on financial institutions.
How do you identify the companies that are invested in nuclear weapons that you choose to avoid?
We have a team of research analysts at our firm that look closely at every company that we are deciding whether or not we can invest in. And they do research to look at what a company's core business model is. So they'll look at their financial documents, they'll look at the company's sustainability reports, and they really dig into how does this company generate revenue? What's their business model? And we have certain thresholds. So if a company generates a certain amount of their business from nuclear weapons, they would be automatically excluded. So more than 10% of their annual revenue from nuclear weapons would be excluded. If it's between like a 5% and 10% amount of their revenue is from that, we would generally exclude it, probably more likely. And then less than 5% of their revenue from nuclear weapons production, we would look at it case by case, but really looking kind of with a negative bias towards investing in that. We look at different factors, like, are they a market leader? Is this their long-term business strategy? Is their messaging really closely tied with the nuclear weapons production? Or are they demonstrating, this is for those companies that aren't significant producers, are they showing that they're moving away from this business? But generally, we have these thresholds where we look at how much of a company's business activity comes from producing nuclear weapons and dig into what their revenue is from. We might look at those lists of government contractors or resources that groups put together to just get a full spectrum of what those companies are. And like ICANN and PACS have also done reporting that's really helpful on those nuclear producing companies. So you can see those names. But my colleagues who are research analysts are really trying to dig in to make sure we have accurate information. And that's one thing that we look at in the investment community is good disclosure. So companies are disclosing their links to nuclear weapons, and that helps more of us to make decisions based on like what is the company's actual business activity and do we want to invest in them?
Many of these companies, I would say the majority of them, are enormous and are known to be very profitable in the business sector. Certainly, they get the majority of the money that's coming dealing with nuclear in order to support the government's stated aims about that. Is there any sense of ridicule or put down or snubbing that comes from those financial institutions that still invest in nuclear, that look at what you're doing, what your company is doing, and think, you know, they're really missing a bet here. They're really stupid. Why are they doing this?
Maybe, but I think for our firm, we really stand on our values and our impact investment standards. So we know that investors who choose to invest with a firm like Domini or those others who are highlighted in the PACS reporting are choosing their investments because they want to invest with a firm that is aligned with their values, that's investing in the kind of world we want to see. So we have done modeling and research over time to look at financial performance and the impact of our screens and standards on financial performance, and that modeling is favorable over time. That's not my area of expertise, so I would leave that to others within the firm to speak to, but we believe strongly that companies that produce things that people need, that are safe, that are accessible, that are fair, are companies that will do well in the long term, and that for investors, you don't need to have those companies in your portfolio to get the kind of returns and have that long-term financial stability that you're really looking for when you make an investment. So I think it's a bit of a false choice to say you're missing out if you exclude these companies, because we actually feel like instead we're able to put money towards things like the renewable energy transition or companies that are making medicines that are accessible and affordable and fair. So thinking about what you want to put your money into in lieu of weapons is part of our approach as well.
I initially became aware of you when I heard you speak at the United Nations last November for the second meeting of states parties on the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. You were on a panel that was put together by ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. What has been your or your company's connection with ICANN, and is there any kind of ongoing relationship?
Yeah, we really are grateful for the work and leadership of ICANN to raise visibility, to provide opportunities for collaboration and education. Right alongside the meeting of the states parties in November, we co-hosted an event with ICANN really geared toward the financial community. And those of us who are looking at this issue as it intersects with the economy. So we had several colleagues from investment firms, research providers, experts who are able to speak to the issue. And part of that was to signal that the financial community is part of this conversation and recognizes it has a role. This wasn't the first event that we co-hosted with ICANN. We did that several years ago as well, because we recognize there's really a close alignment in values there between the work that they're advancing and the approach that we have as an investment firm. At the meeting of the states parties, we had that side event that you referenced, which was really an opportunity for us to signal the support of the financial community. And it, in terms of the outcomes of that meeting, it seems like identifying stakeholders that could be relevant partners presents an opening and an opportunity for the financial community to really step into this work, to signal our support and really build that norm against investment in nuclear weapons.
Is there any kind of an organization or a group that meets representing the various financial institutions that are ethical and looking for more peaceful ways to invest their money? Do you get together to support each other?
Yeah, there's, I think, a really beautiful amount of collaboration among the impact investment, responsible investment community. It doesn't necessarily happen around the issue of nuclear weapons per se, but there are spaces where we do collaboration around issues like biodiversity, like climate change and worker rights, networks like the PRI, Principles for Responsible Investing, or the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, ICCR, where we can gather and share ideas and look for opportunities where we can collaborate. There has been some really good organizing by the firm Ethica Seeger alongside ICANN to put together an investor statement that was supported by over 100 investors and was delivered at the meeting of the states parties, that has really clear expectations from the financial community. So we find different ways to where there's common cause to come together and signal that we care about these issues. We look for opportunities to amplify the message, educate each other, learn about the issues. And I think that increasing awareness among the investor community that was reflected in the Don't Bank the Bomb report shows that more and more investors are looking at this issue and trying to figure out, like, what data do you use? How do you figure this out? What kind of company research are you looking at? Are there places we can go to find the companies that we should avoid? So as those resources are developed, more and more investors can apply their position and their stance against nuclear weapons investing.
How do you bring this opportunity, this stance of the company to the awareness of investors who perhaps are looking around but haven't yet gotten in contact with you?
When we're looking to raise visibility among like other institutional investors or investment firms, things like that statement I referenced are an opportunity to think about others who share this issue, this interest, and who want to invest aligned with their values. So there are some collaborations that are taking place. A group in Europe called Shareholders for Change, for example, has mobilized investors around this. By hosting that event together with ICANN, Domini was also putting our name out there as a firm that's interested in building collaborations and sharing education and resources and creating a conversation around avoiding nuclear weapons investing. And then for the individual person, like a saver, a pensioner, someone who has a 401k or an IRA that wants to think about how they could better align their investments, there are tools and platforms that are resources, like As You Sow, for example, is a group that has different kinds of screens so you can see what are fossil-free investment firms, firms that look against weapons. So an individual investor can find other firms like Domini. Or again, the PAX report shows that list of 110 firms that have already made this commitment. So I think for the individual who's looking to invest in a way that's aligned with their values, it starts with asking questions about, like, does your firm look at nuclear weapons? Are you investing in any of those companies that make them? If you are investing in those companies, how are you using your voice to try to influence them and change their behavior or looking to exit from them, recognizing that changing their behavior might be a long haul?
How much money does an individual have to have an influence on this process?
I mean, I think every dollar invested in the market has an impact. So we really think about putting your money into what you believe the world should stand for and what it should look like. So I would say anyone who has the opportunity to invest should be looking at where they're investing and how they're investing. To open a mutual fund with a firm that has like an impact investment approach, you don't need more than a few thousand dollars. But you can also think about where you're banking. There are banks that are also investing in or financing nuclear weapons. So if even your checking or savings account could be tied to nuclear weapons companies. So I think from an influence standpoint, we really all need to be together and aligned in this. And part of that is creating a norm and a signal. Are we going to get these companies to change their practices overnight by choosing not to invest in them? I'm not sure that's the point of our decisions. Our decisions are to say, I don't want my money going towards this end. And also, there's a norm building around investment firms that are making a similar decision. And eventually that will have repercussions on the company's financial performance or ability to raise capital in the long term. But it's really also part of a movement of standing in solidarity, being public about our position, and thinking about what we'll choose to invest in.
Don't Bank on the Bomb has a superb program that includes ways that people who have extremely modest amounts of money, we're not even talking thousands here, but anyone who has an account can contact their local bank and raise this issue. Not that their amount of money is going to change the stance of the company, but by raising the issue of where are you invested? Are you invested in nuclear weapons creating companies? They will not necessarily have that answer. So what happens is that the question gets raised within the company. So it's not a matter of how much money you have, but whether you have a connection to any kind of a financial institution at all, or a pension, or a 401k, anything that will allow you to bring up this subject and have a definite impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the work I do, so my role is director of engagement. My work is about asking questions of companies. And I think it all really starts with raising the visibility of an issue. So in my work as director of engagement, I meet with companies that our firm is invested in, and I try to understand how they're managing, whether it's climate change or workers' right to form a union or address topics like racial justice and diversity on the board. It starts with that question and inquiry and then brings other people to the table, and the company then has to answer those questions and direct their attention to it. And I think it helps to shape the conversation that investors care about, not just how profitable you are in this quarter, but what kind of company you are, what you're creating, how you treat communities that live adjacent to a factory, or the workers who are producing your products, or the farm workers who are growing the food that you sell in your supermarket. Really, a company's whole business has these impacts. And we know that by asking questions, we start to shape conversations and signal what matters. And then companies have to look for that information, provide that information to their investors, and then investors are able to incorporate that into their decisions about whether to invest in a company. And so, to reinforce your point, for anyone who has a relationship with a credit card company, a bank, a mutual fund, their IRA that they're offered through their company, it's really important to ask about how that aligns with your values, whether it's about nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons testing or nuclear power. Like, all of these questions are important to inquire about.
This, of course, is all of great interest and importance to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners. But I'm wondering, how has the rest of the media responded to your message? Because I do not recall seeing this in mainstream media. What kind of coverage have you gotten, and how positive or opposed to you has it been?
Well, the broader field that we're part of looks at environmental social governance investing, or ESG investing. And I think there's increasing awareness of that type of investing, where you're looking at environmental impacts and social impacts. When it comes specifically to the issue of nuclear weapons, I think we're pleased to see one of the main financial press outlets pick up coverage of the event we co-hosted with ICANN around the meeting of the states parties. And part of their message was similar to what you've asked earlier about the growing interest and awareness of this issue. So I would say, overall, looking at the influence that firms like ours can have on companies is periodically a subject of interest. I wouldn't say that attention is as much as we would need to start to influence companies, but topics like climate change, I think, are really high on people's agenda. And there are a lot of intersections between the impacts of nuclear weapons or the environmental health impacts that are connected to issues that people care about. And part of our work is to build those connections. Nuclear weapons seem like something so abstract and unlikely and kind of disconnected from the day-to-day. And so for investors like Domini that look at issues with kind of a systemic lens, we see this as related to topics we care about, like biodiversity and environmental health and climate change. And that some of the work that ICANN has done has really helped to draw those linkages and help people understand how important this issue is. I don't have more commentary around the mainstream media coverage generally, because our work is not always in the press. So I can't say it's more or less than other things.
What further involvement do you and Domini foresee in your work with ICANN or Don't Bank on the Bomb?
Yeah, I think there is a need to continue to build relationship with ICANN and think about explicitly what the role of the financial sector is related to the treaty. Are there responsibilities for investors and companies that are triggered by the treaty that we need to be aware of? And then for us to think about how to deepen or strengthen or ensure that our standards are kind of like always in the right spot, that there aren't emerging issues that we should be looking at. ICANN can be a resource for that. And I think as more investors are interested in exploring their connection to nuclear weapons, we can be like a bridge or entry point for them to connect with groups like ICANN. So as the member states continue to meet about the treaty I think we'll look to see what the role of the financial community should be and can be. We can support an enabling policy environment where we can advocate for countries to adopt the treaty, maybe, or as a US investor, for example, we don't invest in US treasuries because of the stance of the United States government and the large nuclear weapons arsenal. Advocacy towards the US government around the treaty may not be that easy or successful, but I think we can take other stances where we're looking at the role of governments and the role of investors in supporting that.
So as an individual with admittedly extremely modest means, if I or someone like me was to get involved with making certain that whatever money I have does go towards ethical investing, how would I get started? What would you suggest?
Thinking about the issues that matter to you would be the first step. So what are you looking for when you're choosing an ethical investment? There are firms like ours that have a broad set of impact investment standards where we're looking at topics like ecological sustainability, so climate change, environmental health, and universal human dignity, so like justice and fairness and human rights. And we're applying that set of standards across all of our investments. For an investor that's looking for a firm that like takes that approach, it starts with understanding how did they choose what to invest in and what to avoid. So I think it starts with research, with thinking about what matters to you. If you invest with a financial advisor or through another platform, you can probably find information about those kind of expectations. There are groups, we're part of this organization called USCIF, the Sustainable Investment Forum, and they have a resource about firms that have commitments to sustainable investing. And there are resources available for the everyday investor. I think it starts with that value setting, like what do you care about? And then trying to find a firm that aligns with that set of values.
And in terms of returns, how are such things measured and how does ethical investing shape up in terms of return on investment?
I would direct you to our website where you can find more information about our performance, because that is something where we disclose all of that in our fund fact sheets and our quarterly reporting. And an investor can really dig in and see how our performance aligns with what their needs are. I think there's strong conviction in our founders and our firm's leadership that companies that are well managed, that are responsible, that have good governance, that treat their stakeholders well, will perform well in the long term. And in terms of evaluating performance, because that's not necessarily my role, I don't feel well equipped to speak to that, but I think it's important to dig into that and make sure that the stance of the firm and the performance you're getting meet your needs.
In winding up, is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't covered yet?
I wanted to speak a little bit about our position with our bond fund and investing in sovereigns. So we have a unique stance related to investing in U.S. treasuries, which is that we avoid U.S. treasuries because of the large budget of the U.S. government to invest in the nuclear weapons arsenal. And so instead of that, we invest in affordable housing or healthcare systems or things that are more public goods and creating access to basic goods and services. I mentioned that just to say that across the spectrum of investments, really, there are different places where our commitment to avoid investing in nuclear weapons shows up. And one of those is with our stance against investing in U.S. treasuries.
And what's the minimum amount of money that an individual investor would have to be able to call up Dominion and say, look, let's talk about investing?
So if an individual investor wanted to invest with Domini, they would first start at our website. And the minimum amount to open an investment fund is about $1,500 to $2,500, depending on the type of fund you're looking to open. And through our website, you can find all of that information.
What would an investor looking for information do? Where would they go and what would they have to type in and what would they get as a result? Give us one example.
Yeah, so one resource that's really helpful is the As You Sow Weapons Free Fund website. On that website, you can type into the screen the name of any mutual fund, so like our firm or another firm that you're looking to invest in. It gives you a grade actually on, it says military weapons grade, and it ranks those firms on like A through F, I guess. And it lists specifically what stock holdings that firm may be invested in that are military contractors that produce nuclear weapons or that are manufacturers of controversial weapons. So that screen really helps to do a lot of the research for you on investment firms and what is within the funds. Because like a firm like Domini, we're a mutual fund company, we invest in hundreds of companies, and that's all public on our website. You could see it in our quarterly disclosures. But that's not necessarily that easy to go through if you're an individual investor that's looking to see, like, they say they don't invest in nuclear. Is it true? A resource like this Weapons Free Fund website helps to do some of that work for you and looks through the portfolio of the different funds and gives them that evaluation and then names specifically the companies within the portfolio that are triggered by that screen around nuclear weapons, controversial weapons, or contractors. Some of these tools that are out there really help do the work for an individual investor that wants to make sure, whether it's fossil-free funds or weapon-free or immigrant detention centers, there are resources that will help an investor to align with their values when they're making that decision. Etica SGR has worked with a group called Shareholders for Change, and they organized an investor statement that they delivered at the second meeting of the state's parties. And that was signed by 111 institutional investors with over $1 trillion invested, that encourages countries to sign the treaty, urges state parties to require state-owned enterprises to align with the TPNW, extend the treaty obligations to non-state actors, and also outlines a commitment for the investors that signed that statement not to finance or invest in companies involved in nuclear weapons production. So that was a real advocacy opportunity for the investment community to speak directly at the second meeting of the state's parties. And the firm Etica SGR delivered that investor statement there.
We will, of course, link to that URL on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. Mary Beth Gallagher, you have again proven to be a source of a wealth of information. I was extremely impressed by the session that I attended at the United Nations, and I'm delighted that I was able to finally secure you for an interview. So thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby, so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to speak with you today.
Mary Beth Gallagher, Director of Engagements for Domini Impact Investments. The links mentioned during our interview will be posted on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 725. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 20th, 2025. Guarantee that you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat by signing up for a weekly email at nuclearhotseat.com. Put your first name and email address into the yellow opt-in box, and every week you will get just one email from us with a link to that week's show and a short description of the content. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, in the aftermath of a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. That pretty much sums it up, and this has been your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.